Florida has the highest percentage of students who took the AP exam, but they also have the highest percentage of students who failed it. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A recent investigation by the Florida Phoenix found that more than half of high school graduates who took the AP exam failed it in 2019. Should parents and educators be concerned? Also, we know that South Florida, especially Miami, is a hard place to find affordable housing. This week, housing experts from around the country are in the Magic City to try to figure out why that is. Finally,
my mother stabbed my father with an ice pick because he pushed her. And he was like, Ida, what does that tell you about your mother? I was little. I was like, I don't know. Don't push mommy.
Ada Rodriguez grew up in Homestead. She's come home for a night of comedy, and she'll share why she enjoys telling jokes about the darker moments of life. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Did your kid take an AP exam last year? If so, how did they perform? A recent look into AP exam scores from the Florida Phoenix shows that Florida had a higher percentage of students taking the AP exams than any other state, but it also found that nearly half of the students failed the exam. Still, are students taking AP classes for the same reasons that teachers and parents may hope that they take them? Well, joining us now is Diane Rado of the Florida Phoenix. We're going to try to look into this story. Diane, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for being here.
Let's remind ourselves of what an AP class is and why are students encouraged to take the class and take the test?
Well, advanced placement or AP has been around for, gosh, probably more than 50 years. Myself, I took AP as I think it was English and history at my public high school in the 70s. These were the best courses you could possibly get. They were, I remember my teachers at a public high school were had a doctorate degree. I mean, we were being told that we could do college level classes. And I think and AP has flourished with that and has expanded dramatically from the days when I went to school and even when my kids went to school. There are many, many people who have taken AP, and it's been a very popular program
and
for
these,
many years.
The classes, these mm-hmm. courses, that's basically they're college level. Students can earn college credit while they're in high school.
Well, that's one of the issues. Can they earn credit? The credit is really for college classes. So, for example, when I went on to college, I was able to get credits so that I didn't have to take X classes, or I didn't have to take English or history again because I'd already taken it at school. So what's happening here, though, is the kids are taking the classes, but they're not getting the credits. Why? Because they're not passing the exam. I don't like to use really the word failing, but they didn't pass. If you take an AP exam, you've got to take get a three, four, or five to be able to get that kind of great credit. I can't tell you how important it is for the kids to be able to get those college credits to reduce their tuition bills and to take maybe some other classes that they would not be able to take if they didn't also take AP.
And so that's thank you for making sure we point that out. Is they take the class, but they have to pass the test. If they do, that's college credit. And, of course, if you accumulate enough credits, that's less time you're spending in college. You're getting the savings. So Florida is one of the top five states for administering for the percentage of mm-hmm. students taking these AP classes and taking the exams, mm-hmm. and yet nearly half failed. Do we get a sense of why?
I think this is my view after covering AP for decades. I think that in Florida, they are pushing, and for good reason, they're pushing kids to take the more rigorous classes. We have, for many years in the education system, tracked kids. Some kids take classes that are not rigorous, but we all want kids to take the best classes possible. So that is the issue. If you take the class, that's fine. But if you're not, you must not be doing, you might, maybe you weren't really ready for that class, for example. Maybe it was just too difficult. So you end up taking the class, you end up taking the exam, and then you don't pass. So there's some questions about whether or not it's a good thing to take a class that may be too rigorous.
Two things here, though. What, there's two things. We'll talk about the how rigorous these classes are. But one, you could pass the class but not pass the exam, right?
Correct.
And so you pass the class.
And that's what's happening.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can get a high grade. You get a high grade in the exam or on the in the class. That actually is that A, let's say you get an A, is actually a much more stronger A than just a regular A in a regular class, because that's why we see some kids with GPAs of 5, 6.0.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But again, you said sometimes you see kids taking these way too rigorous courses. Who's pushing them to take those rigorous courses?
Florida.
The state.
Yes. The state of Florida has really been on a roll to get kids in these classes. And I think I'm not sure when that started, but they've even had ninth graders take some of the classes. And I would say, just having been a ninth grader, having my kids be ninth graders, I don't think that kids of that age are prepared to take an AP class. So I'm not, you know, so that's one of the issues, is maybe they're going into a class that is too much. And then you did mention about kids getting an A. Again, I get concerned about grade inflation too. You might have a kid say, yay, I passed this class and I got an A, but when you sit down on the exam and you didn't pass it, then something went awry.
What is the state benefit? What does the state benefit by pushing the kids into these classes?
Well, I think the state does believe that having at least the way the data pieces are, is having at least trying one AP class in their career in high school, and it gets the state would say, and I would say educators would say, that it would prepare kids who are going to college, whether you're going to a community college or you're going to a four-year university. You get that rigor, you get the reading that you have to do, the kind of papers you have to do. It does set you up for, you know, going to college and get going into a more rigorous class than a high school class. So that, and I think, and I'm not saying that there's nothing wrong with that. My concern is that if we're going to have kids take a class, we need to be looking very closely at making sure they pass that class. Because I don't know about you, but I put myself through college, and with the help of extra credits from AP, I was able to get out early, for example.
It's not just helping them pass the class, but be able to pass that exam.
Yes, passing the exam. There are some kids, actually, which is kind of interesting. Some kids, you don't really actually have to take a class to take the AP exam. So there are some kids who actually take the AP exams and they know how to pass them, and then they get credits. And by the way, I do want to mention, because people probably need to know this, I know generally for public universities, they will accept that grade of 3. But I have seen in many cases that some of these schools, colleges, are not taking a 3. They believe that they need a 4 or a 5 to actually say, hey, you can get credit. So I think parents and kids need to think about not just passing, but really passing with a 4 or 5.
Yeah. And again, because the scores are 1 through 5, and again, 1 being the lowest, 5 being the highest. We're talking with Diane Rado of the Florida Phoenix. She recently wrote about the fact that Florida, again, has the highest percentage of high school students taking AP exams, but nearly half failed. Now, if you're a student or parent of one, tell us about your AP exam experiences. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Did you take the class for the grade, or take the exam and earn that credit? Or maybe you skipped the class and you just took the exam. We got an interesting message, by the way, from one of our listeners. This is from the Monroe County School Superintendent from their office. From my experience as Vice Chair of Florida State Board of Education, my view, high participation is more important than the scores. Kids get challenged, and getting a 2 instead of a 3 or above passing is better than not attempting the course and the exam. That's from John Padgett. What's your take on that? You hear that. What do you think?
Yeah, I understand because my youngest son decided he wanted to take AP Economics. And I kept thinking, okay, well, I hope, okay, that's fine. And he ended up getting, like, I think the first semester a D in this class. And then I think he ended up with a C. I think he didn't bother to do the exam, but I often interview my own kids. I asked my son, was it worth it? And he said yes. He was glad that he at least, he was in a class where everybody was smart.
He said it was worth it. Why?
Yeah, because I was saying. He was in the group of kids who were smart kids. And they were learning a lot. He didn't want to be with, again, we've talked about the issue of tracking that still goes on. He didn't want to be in a class where everybody didn't look that smart. He wanted to have that experience of really smart honors type kids.
He
don't even think he took that econ exam. He did move on to taking a major in history, and he's now ready to be a lawyer. He's going to be a law school student. So
it worked out.
And so I do see why people say that, but I still think in the era of the money that is being used for tuition, and I think kids should be able to pass and be able to get these credits unless somebody decides, like, I don't know, one of the presidential candidates that, well, let's just have free tuition, then that's a different story.
How about this, though? Yeah. I mean, don't schools also benefit? Like, if you have a lot of students taking and passing the exam, mm-hmm. isn't that money for schools, bonuses for teachers?
Well, I don't think it's money. I think it's prestige as well. I mean, for example, this report I was looking at was about the state essentially boasting and bragging that, you know, we had all these kids take this exam. It looks good. It really does. And they can put out a press release and say, hey, everybody's taking an exam.
It's not, you know, but what? It's not money for schools, but isn't it? Is it goes towards the grade for the school, though, because the schools are graded.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure on the high school level, that's one of the metrics is AP. I'm pretty sure it's AP, or it's at least the percent of kids who get a three, four, or five. So yes, that is part of the grade for high school. But I also think it's just really great to have this press release come out and say that we've all had all these classes. And I think there's a lot of issues to me still with race issues. You know, our black student, I mean, the data on AP, you know, the black students are not taking AP as much or getting as many passing exams. So there's a lot going on with AP that I think needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
In terms of our state, not AP. The College Board has again, for decades, been doing this and doing it very well.
It's this, how we handle it. The highest passing level exams were in languages, Spanish, Chinese, and mm-hmm. Italian. Some of the lowest scores were in U.S. history, chemistry, and environmental science. What are educators saying about that?
I have not heard. I didn't realize until I was looking at the data that the languages were high. But again, I think on those categories, there weren't as many kids taking those classes. So it may have been just the best group of kids on the planet, and they're all already super smart, and they maybe tried to take Chinese earlier. So we don't know about that. It's the ones at the bottom. U.S. history is one of the highest taking exams. For them to not be passing is a concern, especially because as the Florida is pushing for, you know, new civics standards,
right,
and what we should know about the Constitution and our founding fathers and all that. So I don't know what's happening there, but it is a concern.
The state with the highest passing rate mm-hmm. on AP exams was New Jersey. They also
yep.
happen to have the mm-hmm. highest starting salaries for public school teachers. Is there a correlation?
I think so. Yes, I do. The New Jersey folks, they are making, the teachers are making a lot of money. I think the minimum is, I think, is 62. A lot of them are over 100,000. When I was living in Illinois for years in Chicago, I mean, the teachers were making over $100,000 at my kids' schools and high schools. And Illinois, by the way, had a high number of passing. And I just do. I've been covering school finance forever, and I really think that wages for teachers, getting those best teachers, teachers with masters or doctorates, to teach these kids. I think that makes a difference.
We think about the fact that, you know, again, Governor DeSantis is proposing raising starting salaries.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, just as a point, I don't know if that's something, if you've heard from educators, if that's, you know, we've heard from a lot of them. And I guess it depends on if you're new or if you've been around for a while.
Yeah.
Whether or not
I think the 47.5 that the governor talked about would be monumental and a national story. That would be huge to do to and I but I'm not as the legislature is moving forward, I'm not seeing that the governor's going to get that 47.5 right away, at least.
Right.
But it would have been a monumental thing to do.
You said earlier too, not all schools take these, and we got a call from a listener. Melanie from Boca Raton asking, not all universities take AP credit courses. What schools do?
They you have to, if you're a mom and dad and the kid who's trying to go to college, you need to be vigilant and be vigilant and looking at if you can accept those. I know how, you know, the Harvards and the Princetons, the Ivy Leagues, I think they need like a 5.
Right.
I really do.
Right.
But you have to look at this, because it would be the difference for me to go to a different school if they were going to take the 3s. I know in Illinois, for example, that the state law changed, and the public universities had to take the 3. And I believe Florida is probably the same. Most of the public universies want to do the 3, but most of these private schools that are, you know, high ranked, again, the Ivy Leagues and the Northwesterns and University of Chicago's and those, they need 4 and 5s. So you just
check.
Have to be.
You got to check.
Yeah, check. Yes.
Diane Rado, the Florida Phoenix. Again, you can find her story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Really fascinating. Again, Florida, highest percentage of students taking the AP exams, nearly half fail the test. Diane, thank you so much for the information.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. And we've heard from other listeners, by the way. Ian tweeted at us, I graduated high school in 2019. I felt enormous pressure to take AP classes. I have a younger brother in the 7th grade, and now they're trying to get them to skip pre-algebra and go straight to algebra. Christina Beretta emailed us. I worked at a Broward Public High School. One of the reasons students get put in AP classes is because part of the school grade depends on how many students get an acceleration. These are fascinating takes. By the way, I took a lot of honor classes. Didn't take the AP classes, though. Well, still to come, housing experts are in Miami this week to better understand how we in South Florida handle the lack of affordable housing. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. National housing experts and policymakers are in Miami to discuss the biggest challenges facing the nation's affordable housing crisis. They're here for the Urban Land Institute's Housing Opportunity Symposium. In Miami, about 6 in 10 residents spend more than 30% of their paycheck on housing. This is the highest rate of any large metro area. Christopher Tomey is the executive director of the Urban Land Institute's Terwilliger Center for Housing, and he's in town here for the symposium. Christopher, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis. It's great to be here with you.
The Urban Land Institute recently released the Home Attainability Index. This looks at housing affordability and who's able to buy homes in the current housing market. In South Florida, is buying a home realistic?
Well, and our index looks at home attainability both from a rental and from an ownership perspective. And I would say that from an ownership perspective, it's a little bit easier to become a homeowner in many cases here than trying to find a rental property that can be afforded. The rental situation is a particular challenge that's being seen here in the South Florida area right now. If you look at those families that are households paying more than half of their incomes in housing, so what we call severely housing cost burden, you really have about 25% of households who are earning between $30,000 and $45,000dollars a year, or about 25%, are paying more than half of their income on their housing, and that leaves very little to go for all of the other things that you need to do.
How do you determine affordability? Is it about what the market is offering, or about how much we're making?
Well, it's really it's primarily an income problem. It's a mismatch between incomes and cost, and that's really a challenge wherever you are in the country. In many of the urban areas where you have higher incomes, that's overwhelmed by the higher housing costs that you see in those areas as well. A kind of rule of thumb in housing is that you should pay no more than 30% of your income. At that point, you become housing cost burdened. And one of the things we heard from presenters this week at our conference was that when you hit about an average of about a 32% cost burden, you start seeing homelessness tick up again. So in some parts of the country, we've seen some substantial improvement over the last decade or so in homelessness. But as the affordability problem got more difficult and the cost inched up above that 30% standard, we've seen homelessness grow.
I'm just going by what I see. And you know, first of all, you think about Miami, South Florida especially, is very unique in that, look, this is a tourist hotspot. So we have a lot of service workers not making a lot of money. And yet you also see growth in construction. So I'm trying to put the two together and understand, like, so really you got a lot of people who are needed. We need these service workers, and yet they're not making enough to buy houses, right? I mean, that's what I'm looking at.
That's right. And there's really a shortage of units overall. And that's something that we're seeing, particularly in the coastal areas in the country. There just aren't enough units being built to keep up with the folks moving in. And the other problem you have is you're not building the right kinds of units.
Okay, yeah, because I was about to say affordable units, because there's a lot of construction going on, but not something that everybody can afford.
That's right. And it's always a question of affordable to whom. And I think if you're looking at what's traditionally been called that workforce housing, so people who are earning 80% of median income, maybe up to 120%, or the lower income, so looking below the 80% mark, it's really, really difficult to find housing that you can afford at those income levels. And one data point that we've seen that's troubling, for every 100 households that earn half of the median income in South Florida, there are only 25 available rental units that are affordable to
those households.
That's right. And these are households that primarily probably wouldn't be looking at ownership. And so that's a substantial shortage of units that's going to have to be dealt with over time. I think the good news is that right now you're seeing in Miami more units being built over the last 10 years than population moving in, and that's a good sign. But clearly, when you look at the affordability numbers, it hasn't been enough.
Why Miami? Why is the symposium here?
Well, I think
besides the weather, by the way.
Well, so the weather is certainly a consideration. It's been very nice, especially for those of us coming down from the Northeast. But I think in a lot of ways, Miami is a microcosm of housing problems that we're seeing nationally. As I mentioned, that supply problem, the mismatch between the kinds of units that are being built and the kinds of units that there's real need and demand for. These are problems that you may be seeing at a little bit higher level here in Miami than in some other parts of the country. But they're really some very similar challenges to what other folks are facing. And if you can solve them here in Miami, you can solve them in a lot of places.
So, you know, I mean, we obviously have a lot of policymakers. We have a lot of politicians we bring in here and talk about this issue. How do we deal with the affordable housing? All right. And there are projects in the works. But as I mentioned, I look around. I've been here 6 years now, and I look around at just the projects in this area, and half a dozen high rises have gone up. Some are rentals, some are for sale. But again, I see that, and then I look at them, and half of them look empty, or half empty. They're dark. And I keep thinking, so we're building, but who's filling the space if there's a need?
That's right. And my understanding is that there has, particularly on the condominium side, been some overbuilding in recent years and some oversupply on that end. I think the good news is there are some really great projects that are happening here in Miami.
I don't want to make it sound like the people are not making the effort to build affordable housing.
Absolutely. And I know that the city and county have worked very well with some developers. I visited a development today called Liberty Square that's really an amazing development. They're going to more than double the number of units that are on the ground there. Now, many of those units were in awful condition. They're doing it in a way that there's absolutely zero displacement. Anyone who lived there previously either has a renovated unit to live in or is moving into one of the new units. And so I think there is good news happening in the Miami area, but you could always use more of that. You could always use more of those units that are focused. And again, most of those units will be at 80% of median income, going all the way down to the 30% and below that public housing serves.
I'm talking with Christopher Tomey. He's the executive director of the Urban Land Institute's Terwilliger Center for Housing. We're discussing the big challenges facing housing affordability here in South Florida. Again, as mentioned, they're having the symposium here in Miami, leaders from around the country, because as he's mentioned, if we could see what's going on in Miami, this could might teach everybody else, you know, what best practices are. You talk about the issue of affordability of renting versus buying, but a key consideration is access to credit. Access to mortgages, especially for low-income communities of color. What changes have we seen over the decade after the foreclosure crisis in terms of access to that money?
Well, I think it's been a challenge. I think that there was a post-crisis. There was the Dodd-Frank legislation that came out that substantially increased the regulation of banking in general and mortgages in particular, and much of that was needed to prevent a future similar kind of crisis from happening. But it seems that maybe some of those went a bit overboard because you have seen a restriction in credit availability, particularly, of course, at the low income end of things. And I think that we're starting to see financial institutions come out with some more innovative products that are enabling them to reach further down in income levels and get to some families who really are well qualified to take on a mortgage but haven't had it available to them. So I think we're seeing in the lending industry now a lot of effort to reach those families who are really ready to buy. But we certainly haven't gotten back to the point where we need to be in terms of credit availability. And particularly minority home ownership was just devastated during the housing crisis. And a lot of focus still needs to be given to ensuring that those communities that were particularly harmed in the crisis have a way to climb back, have the American dream again, own their own homes, and get back to where they were a decade or 15 years ago.
You know, going back to the index, I'm just curious if there's anything, any good news or discoveries that benefit South Florida that we can look to?
Well, I think one of the things that I mentioned earlier was on the ownership side. If you look at median income, nearly half the homes in South Florida last year that were sold at a level affordable to a median income household. So that's a fairly encouraging metric. If you go down the scale, it's not quite as encouraging. You get to the 40th percentile, then you're getting down to fewer than a third of the homes were affordable. But it's not bad to be able to have half of them at that median income level. And I think the other good news that we saw is a little bit of a good news, bad news. The index, one of the things that we look at is income segregation. And the bad news is in South Florida, there's a lot of it. And Raj Shetty and a group of economists several years ago did a study that pretty clearly showed that the zip code that you're raised in pretty much can predict the outcomes of your life in many, many ways, health, education, many of the family outcomes that you're looking for. And so income segregation can be a big concern. The good news is you have a good transit system here in South Florida.
You say that, and we've had this conversation a lot of times about how, wow, our transit system here is terrible, and we struggle with it.
Well, I would say, It's better than a substantial number of the locations, and we evaluated about 85 different major metropolitan MSAs. It's better than many of those that we evaluated in some of these cities. So, within our range of cities that we looked at, and particularly in some that have similar kinds of income segregation problems, the transit situation here is better.
By what metrics, though? How are we better?
And that I'd have to refer you. This is we use another organization's transit metric, and I don't have deep knowledge of how they've.
Ben, you get a lot of cynicism here in the city because we're always complaining about that. Okay, so here's the thing too. Looking at other cities, tell me, because look, it's easy to just say we live in our little bubble of South Florida, and so we could say we know what housing is like here. Compare us to other places, then. How are we doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you look at overall affordability, it's not as well as some areas. So you're looking at, again, about a quarter of folks who are spending more than half of their incomes on housing. If you look at some of the cities that have really been building housing in recent years, if you look at Birmingham, if you look at Memphis, if you look at Raleigh, and of course, these are different kinds of cities than Miami, but they have a better balance between housing production and housing need. And I think that's what the real difference. And they only have 6-7% of their population that are spending more than half of their incomes on housing.
I think back to the fact that, owning a home, that was part of the American dream, mm-hmm. but it was attainable a long
That's
time
right.
ago because, even go back to the 70s or 80s, a person's median income, you could afford housing, education, healthcare, and still have some money left over. And today, we're behind. We're behind on all being able to pay all this stuff. And housing seems it's almost like it's a more of an investor's game. It's about speculation. Is that what's happened? And do we ever get back to that point where it's attainable again?
Well, I think it really comes down to the degree, the cost to build. It's hard to control on the income side, and so what you can do on the development side is try to reduce those costs of putting a unit on the ground, and there are really three big buckets that you can look at there. One of them is land costs, and there are ways to get at that by increasing density, for example, that help bring that cost down for land. One of them is regulatory cost, and that's taxes and fees as well as process. In across the country, you're seeing anywhere from 5-20% cost increases on a year-over-year basis. And so the longer timelines that you have to getting projects on the ground, the more and more expensive that gets over time. And then you have your construction costs. And with labor shortages, some of the material costs that have gone up in recent years, it's just been very, very difficult to get those on the ground.
Let me finish with this. The other thing is this. This is a no income tax state. So, the thing is that we depend a lot on the revenue from, our housing taxes. So, it's we're going to build, but at the same time, of course, that's why it's so attractive to build the high-end condos.
That's right.
Revenue for the cities, revenue for the counties.
Absolutely. And I think, There are a lot of things that make it difficult to put those units on the ground, but political situation and the real policy implications are almost always at the core of it.
I just keep holding this idea that you just said that we have really good transit here, and I'm going to bring this up to the next conversation I have on that. Christopher Tomey, again, Executive Director of the Urban Land Institute's Terwilliger Center for Housing. Christopher, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis. I appreciate the chance to be here.
All right. Still to come, Miami comedian Ada Rodriguez back in South Florida. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami native Ida Rodriguez has established herself as a successful comedian in Los Angeles. In recent years, she was featured in the Netflix special They Ready, produced by Tiffany Haddish. She was also in the Robert De Niro film The Comedian and numerous specials on Comedy Central. Rodriguez has an unbelievable and sometimes tragic life story traveling around the country at times against her will, and she's used that tragedy in her comedy. She's not afraid to tell those stories. She's performing at the Miami Improv tomorrow night. She joins me now in studio. Ida, I think I've been saying Ada, but Ida, you're yes. used to that, right? You've been hearing Ada, right?
Well, yeah, you know, the thing is, like, Ada is English, Ida's in Spanish. And with my name in particular, it's really funny because, like, Eva Mendez, I'm sure she doesn't go around telling people, it's Eva. But my grandmother's both, they're both named Ida. So I was asked to please honor the name because it didn't belong to me.
Well, you know what? I mean, I'm Luis Hernandez, but I go by Luis. So, you know.
Yeah, it's all good.
You had a passion for the arts growing up. You mm-hmm. were living with your grandmother at one time. But I wanted to know, when did you know that you wanted to move to Los Angeles to pursue a career in entertainment?
So the thing is that my mom was telling me the last time I was here that I used to carry a walk around with a broomstick, and I would read scriptures, I would tell jokes, I would sing songs. She's like, you've always wanted to be in the entertainment business. I've always wanted to do it. I think I just became brave enough to do it when I finally moved to Los Angeles to go out and pursue a career in film is what I went out.
You were doing modeling and acting.
Right, and I was writing. So I wanted to write feature films that told stories that were familiar with me and the people that I looked like. And, you know, I went out there, and then comedy is something that I just started doing afterwards. It fell upon me. I had always wanted to do it since I was little, but I was talked out of it because I was told that that was for boys.
Yeah. What was it like, by the way, when you got to Los Angeles and you're pursuing this career, again, acting, modeling, and writing?
Yeah. You know what? It was freedom. You know, it was the first time that I felt like I was really on my own in life. And so I had been dominated by the people in my village for so long that moving to Los Angeles felt like freedom. And even though I was a mom at the time and I felt like, oh, man, this is not going to be easy, there was still a sense of relief that I was on the path to doing what I really wanted to do and set out that I was supposed to be there.
And then so how do you go from acting and modeling and writing to comedy?
So one day I have a friend who's she has a birthday party and she invites me to come roast her. And I'm like, why me? Like, you know, all these comedians and invites an actual professional comedian to come roast her as well, who's a friend of hers. She was like, because I like your wit. I like your sensibility. I know you're going to be thoughtful. And so I do the roast. And then the guy who's there, his name is Chris Spencer, who actually created the show with Kevin Hart, The Real Husbands of Hollywood. He comes up to me after the roast and he's like, I don't know if you know this about you, but you are a comedian. And he was like, I don't know what you're waiting on, but you need to get on with it because that's where you're supposed to be. And he gave me a list of open mics. And then I was like a closeted comic. I started doing these open mics when I wasn't working. And he was right. It was as soon as I, the second time I did it on stage, like the first time I did well. So that was deceiving. And all comedians will say that there's so much adrenaline that you do well. But
right.
The second time I did horribly bad. And that's when I said, oh, now I really want to do this. Like if the bad feeling still felt good. And I was like, I got to figure this thing out.
Wow. It's when you fall on your face and you're like, okay.
Yeah. Now I was like, okay, now, because it was too easy at first and it wasn't fulfilling.
Anyone who's not familiar with your comedy, you know, is that you don't shy away from some of the difficult content. Mm-hmm. You embrace it. This is a clip, by the way, of one of your stand-ups.
My mother stabbed my father with an ice pick because he pushed her. And he was like, Ida, what does that tell you about your mother? I was little. I was like, I don't know. Don't push mommy.
You know, I mentioned it in the opening. So your life story is fascinating. My understanding is, as a child, you were kidnapped.
Yeah, I was twice.
Okay, tell me about the first one. What happened?
So it was parental kidnap,
right?
But nonetheless, kidnap. My mom and I lived in the Dominican Republic with my mother and my father. And
so you're from Puerto Rico.
Yeah, my mom's Puerto Rican.
You've been taken.
My dad is
okay.
Dominican,
okay.
And so she took me from him.
Why?
In the middle of the night. Well, there were just lots of issues, colorism issues with his family. There was an age difference that was very significant in where they were in life. My dad was in his mid to late 20s. My mom was a teenager. There was infidelity. There was so many things that were going on, and she just grabbed her baby and left But, you know, my dad was undocumented, so he couldn't come back to the States because he had been deported. So she knew that if she took me and brought me back to the States, she would be successful in keeping him away from us. And she did.
You know what? And then the other time was, what, it was your grandmother, because I mentioned you were living with your grandmother here in South Florida.
Yeah. My grandmother took me from my mom.
Okay.
I was like the chess piece that everybody kept trying to steal.
Wait, but when you were a kid, did you understand what all this stuff that was happening?
No. And you know what's funny is that the reason I decided to talk about it and write about it is because when people talk about familial kidnap, it is as if it's not traumatic, as if it's not real because it's a family member, or if your mom steals you from your dad. But the reality of it is that you're being taken from your parent or your family. And it is traumatic. So for me, when my grandmother took me from my mother, as flawed and as many issues as my mom had at the time, she's still my mom. And I felt, you know, I felt a great sense of loss being taken from her. And I can still feel that now as an adult, that when I think back to that moment of being taken from my mom, how sad I was that I was not, when I wouldn't see my mom every day.
You know, something I noticed in I've had the opportunity, it's a blessing that I've had in this job. I've had the chance to talk to a lot of comedians. Mm-hmm. And something I noticed is like, they're the comedians who love to share their life story.
Yeah.
But it almost seems like the darker that story, the better. Do you get that sense?
Well, I mean, the thing is, especially now in this age of realness, when everybody is like, we want the truth, we want it real, we want it raw. Yeah. But I just think also that because comedians come from such dark places, that in sharing the stories, that they also are healing, you know, one joke at a time. It's cathartic. It's very cathartic. And so it's therapy, if you will, you know. You're just doing it with strangers.
How do audiences respond to you when you tell these stories?
My audiences love it. I have so many people reach out to me on all the issues and tell me, I can relate to you on this. My mother took me from my father here. I was homeless. I was also kidnapped by a family member. My father got deported. I've been sexually assaulted. You run the spectrum of all the issues that I talk about. People come to me and say, thank you for saying it.
Because sometimes you get laughs, but sometimes you have uncomfortable moments.
Oh, yeah.
You told my producer about one on a cruise ship.
Oh, yeah. Those are the worst.
Okay.
Cruise ships are where comedy goes to die.
Oh, my gosh.
It's horrible. The problem with the cruise ships, and that's per my perception, some people really love them, is that you have a captive audience of people who are there for entertainment.
Right.
And when they go to a comedy club, they don't go to a comedy club to hear a specific point of view of comedy. They just go because they want to laugh and they want you to adjust to them. And so what happens is that, like, people never walk upon a concert and say, let's see what kind of music they're playing. You know,
right.
People research it, but they don't do that with comedy. They walk into a comedy show and say, make me laugh. And you have to research your comedians the same way you research your music artists. If you don't like country music and you walk into a Garth Brooks concert, you can't complain because Garth Brooks is singing country music. No different than comedy. If you walk into a comedy show and that comedian is blue or that comedian is political and you don't want to hear that, you should have researched it. And so they come into the show. So I go to this show. It was like a scene from Anchorman, the scene when they opened the cologne and it was just pure havoc. That is what it turned out to, because like the guy that was opening for me, these people got into an argument in the audience and the lady had an accent. And one of the other members said, go back to your country. This is America. We really were not in America. We were on Mexican waters. So it was just, I was like, it's so much to unpack here. We just got to just get out of here safely. Somebody was offended because I referred to my daughter as the B word. And it's one of my bigger jokes. And they were very appalled by the fact that I called my own daughter the B word. And I was talking about my daughter who was a late teenager, you know, but it's just so funny in her late teens. It's just so funny to hear, you know, what offends people now.
So don't do cruise comedy. All right.
I retired. It was my first cruise and my last cruise. I told my agent, don't you ever
ever.
Talking with comedian Ida Rodriguez back in South Florida, again, where she spent her teen years. And she's got a set at the Miami Improv coming up on Thursday. You can get more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. You know, we were joking at the beginning because you're Puerto Rican heritage, mm-hmm. As I am. But it's important for you. You've been very engaged, especially in the recovery efforts after Hurricane Maria and the earthquakes. But when's the last time you were there?
Oh, I haven't been there for a while. It's been about 10 years since I've been there. And I was going to go during the hurricane relief, but I decided to donate the money that I would use to go there and take up space there for the people who needed it on the ground. Mm. We sent three planes over there. We sent six Amazon boxes that provided each for a family for 6 months that had generators and water and food, had everything in each box. So for me, it was more important to help than to go there just to take pictures and show people that I went there to help. It was more important for me to get the stuff there.
Do you have a relationship, though, with the mayor of San Juan, right?
Oh, with Yulene, with Mayor Cruz.
Mayor Cruz.
Yeah, she was very helpful. We did World AIDS Day here, and she was very thankful to me. I can pick up the phone and call her, and she said, whenever you send something, call me so I can make sure that it gets where it needs to go.
What has she said about what's been going on mm-hmm. these last few years and what's happening on the island and with mm-hmm. the people and what they need? What is she telling you?
Well, she was at the time. There was so many needs that were not being met. Because yes, people were sending stuff, but there were no truck drivers, right? So she was like, "What? In practical terms, we need to know what the people actually need, because what happens with people when they are helping others? A lot of times, we like to decide for the people what we think they need. Well, it's important for you to have water. What was important for them to have was transportation and security and people to make sure to facilitate that the things got, because there were like cases and cases of water that sat there for months because they didn't have the guys to deliver the people to deliver them. So she was just telling me that it was important to understand what the needs were, to really talk to somebody on the ground there, not just what to get there, but how to get there, because a lot of times people were just sending stuff and it was overwhelming.
And it was in a lot of cases sitting in a dock.
Yeah.
Just waiting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you talk about your Puerto Rican heritage in your shows, mm-hmm. but also your identity as an Afro-Latina.
Yes.
How does being Afro-Latina differentiate you from other comedians in the industry?
Oh, wow. It differentiates me because there aren't that many. I don't know of any. I think I may know of one, another one. The thing is that I've been identifying with my Afro-Latinidad for a very long time because my grandmother was a Black Puerto Rican woman. So it was something that, and my uncles, you know, are Black, and my mom is white. So I have a joke about how Puerto Rican families have like they represent the entire spectrum. In each family, they got an Asian, they got a Black one, a white one, and everything in between. And my joke is that my friend was like, "How many fathers?" And I'm like, "Actually, just one." And his name is colonization, because it's the reality of what what people on the islands are. So I think it's important for us to talk about, specifically in Puerto Rico, where the African culture and heritage there is so rich because it is in the language, it is in the music, it is in the religion, it is in the food. I think it's just paying homage to our ancestors.
Why do you think, because you just said you could only name one other one, why do you think there are only so few? They've got to be more. I mean, are producers, promoters, are they not thinking about that? Do they just...
Well, I mean, it's really hard to actually in the comedy space, entertainment as a whole, there's this, they still think we're a monolith as in terms of Latinos, right? They still say the Latino market. There's no such thing as a Latino market. You know, there's a Caribbean market, there's a Central American market. People from Spain are not Latinos. They are Europeans who speak Spanish.
Right.
Like, so there's so much to unpack there. And a lot of people don't really understand.
They just see us because we speak Spanish.
Yeah, that we're all the same thing. And they don't realize that culturally, you know, even within, you know, our own communities, that there's so much that people don't know. So when they see us, they only see this thing. And they're like, why aren't you guys showing up for this? We gave you a Mexican show. And we're like, you know, even the Mexicans are not showing up for the Mexican show because this is a Mexican show written by white men. And they're telling the story per their perception of what Mexicans are. And so that's so problematic. So that is why you don't hear about other Afro-Latinos, because a lot of people don't want to even claim their blackness because of the anti-blackness that exists everywhere.
Comedian Ida Rodriguez, she's back home in South Florida, and again, she's doing improv tomorrow. You can find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I'd love to keep talking, but I got to stop. But
I love it. Such a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Ida. I really appreciate it.
Stop gentrifying Miami.
And that's Sundial for this Wednesday, February 26th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, NPR's Ari Shapiro is going to be in Miami this weekend. You know him as one of the hosts of All Things Considered, but did you know he also sings? Yeah, he does. And we're going to talk about that. He's with the band Pink Martini. By the way, you're listening to him right now. But getting late and my boys are waiting. Gotta get something to eat. That's Ari Shapiro. Also, coming up tomorrow, we're going to have our Sundial Book Club conversation. We've been talking about Cat's Tale. That's the book that we've been reading. And one of the characters in the book we're going to have on the show tomorrow. By the way, tomorrow we're also going to mention the March title. And I got a little teaser up on our Facebook page right now, so you can go there. Join the book club. It's free. Love to have you. Let us know what you think. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Say, you don't have any cash I could borrow, do ya? It's all right. Shine on Spot Me. She always does. I'll be back. You'll see.